देश का पहला चुनाव देख रहा हूं जहां विपक्ष जीत का दावा नहीं कर रहा है। किसी विपक्ष के नेता से आपने सुना कि भाई उनकी सरकार बनेगी? सुना?
Intense drama in Ranchi, and the enforcement directorate has arrested Hemant Soren after almost 8 hours of questioning in Ranchi.
Now, opposition leaders including Mallikarjun Kharge, Rahul Gandhi, Bhagwant Mann, Akhilesh Yadav and Tejaswi Yadav are scheduled to participate in a Save Democracy rally at the Ram Leela Maidan today. The India Bloc's Loktantra Bachao rally is perceived as a protest of solidarity and opposition unity, particularly following the recent arrest of Delhi Chief Minister Arvind Kejriwal just ahead of the Lok Sabha election.
You're listening to State of South Asia, a podcast from Himal South Asian, where we speak to some of the best minds on the region today to unpack crucial issues affecting our politics, cultures, environments, and societies. I'm your host, Nayantara. India is going into a brutal summer and a fraught election season. The general election will be held in 7 phases, starting on April 19th, going on till June 1st. With counting held on June 4th, a time during which there could be up to 20 heatwave days across the country. The ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, led by Narendra Modi, is going to try and build on its previous electoral success and on its decade in power, with an aim of getting more than 370 of 543 parliamentary seats. The opposition alliance, led by the Indian National Congress, will try its best to pull off a huge upset and form the government. General elections in India that are conducted every 5 years have always been largely free and fair. But the run-up to this year's election has been markedly different from previous years, with a rash of developments. There have been questionable changes to the Election Commission and revelations about an electoral bond scheme that had led to outsized funding to the BJP and possible quid pro quos to donors. The courts have now declared the scheme unconstitutional. There has also been a crackdown on the opposition that has led to 2 state chief ministers in prison and a freezing of the Congress Party's funds. Suddenly, India's elections are not looking so free and fair. Akar Patel now joins us to discuss the atmosphere of this election and its significance to the maintenance of democracy in India and South Asia. Akar worked as a journalist in the 1990s and 2000s, then moved to head Amnesty India, and is currently the chair of Amnesty. He continues to write columns and is an astute observer of Indian politics and of Narendra Modi. He is the author of 2 works of non-fiction, Our Hindu Rashtra and Price of the Modi Years, and also of a novel called After Messiah. Akar, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure.
We're recording this on the 3rd of April, when the big headline in the Indian Express is a story that since 2014, 25 opposition leaders who were investigated for corruption joined the BJP, and then cases against 23 of them had been closed. There are a number of such stories coming out, and you have tweeted some of these with the comment, free and fair, that basically shows that the BJP has been using state machinery to undermine any opposition and to give itself an unfair electoral advantage. So Indian elections have not been perfect in the past, but is India about to have its least free and most unfair election?
I would say so. That we've, as you've said, we've never had the perfect election, whether by way of no violence or by way of candidates spending much more than they're actually allowed to, or the raising of money through sources that are not strictly legal, perhaps even a criminal. And all of that has come in the past. I think what is new is that the criminal activity is coming from the state. What the news reports on the misuse of the ED tell us, besides anything else, is that the state is acting in a thuggish fashion as a criminal, using power, abusing power that is at its command to bully, browbeat, and pretty much destroy the opposition. If we go back to the emergency, which is the event that the BJP keeps taking us back to as the symbol of the lack of democracy after 1947. It came after Indira Gandhi was disqualified in the main for 2 things. One is misuse of official machinery, by which the court meant the use of loudspeakers, barricades, and government officers on deployment. This has become a commonplace. I think that the government of India, Modi, used uses and misuses the machinery at his disposal in orders of magnitude more times than Indira Gandhi was accused of and convicted of. But it's not commented on. I think that it's taken for granted that such a thing will happen. We don't even need to go into the other things at this point on the bonds or what is happening in terms of jailing people. Purely the abuse of state machinery by itself would constitute, I think, finding that this is India's least fair and least free poll.
There's also an undermining of institutions. And, you know, the one that we should talk about going into elections is the Election Commission. There was a time where the EC was considered what former Chief Election Commissioner T.N. Seshan calls the government's sidekick. But in fact, Seshan is credited with bringing a certain degree of autonomy to the Election Commission and making political parties take things like the Model Code of Conduct very seriously. And this was during his tenure between 1990 and 96. But now again, the government has made changes to how the Election Commission is constituted, cutting the Chief Justice of India out of the process, and now instituting bureaucrats who have been reported to be close to the Prime Minister and the Home Minister Amit Shah. What does this say about the prospects for how this election will be conducted?
It won't be free and fair. And I think the EC is the handmaiden of the government. The reason why we have the longest drawn out poll in our history is because the BJP wants it that way, Modi wants it that way. For what reason, I don't know. There's no reason for us to assume that India is less safe today, less capable today in the sense of the bureaucracy and the police than it was 30, 40 years ago. But that's what the government is telling us, that we need a poll that begins in April and ends in June because of the fact that it's required to be that. The government is telling us this through the EC for sure, but I'm saying that there is no difference to my mind between what the EC says and what the government wants. The other thing that occurs to me is that if some gains are very hard fought and very hard to come by. And I think the victories in the 80s of the Election Commission was one of them, that you had in some way a clawing back from the government in office of authority over the polling apparatus, which we have squandered again. And I think that hard-fought gains like that are very difficult in our part of the world to achieve in the first place. And it's disappointing that we have let that achievement go with the ease that we have.
Right. So, you know, now I want to talk about the biggest story in this news cycle, also because it's emblematic of the kind of gaming of electoral politics that we're seeing today. And that is, of course, of the electoral bonds. Just a quick brief for our listeners. The union budget in 2017 brought in a number of electoral reforms. The electoral bonds was the major one, which allowed anonymous electoral bonds in which a donor can donate to a political party without revealing his identity. But there were also a couple of other changes. One is that there was a cap on cash donations, which was reduced from 20,000 rupees to 2,000 rupees, but there was no cap on the total number of donors. And on corporate funding, there was a cap that was earlier fixed at 7.5% of the average annual profits of a company, and that cap was removed. Now, of course, we know on electoral bonds, with the Supreme Court of India striking it down, calling it unconstitutional, and demanding that the State Bank of India reveal all the details. We know the patterns that have emerged, that the BJP is obviously one of the biggest beneficiaries of the scheme, but also that there has been a kind of quid pro quo. There have been, you know, reporters have established patterns of institutions like the CBI and the ED going under after certain companies, donations then being made through electoral bonds to the BJP, and then those investigations being closed. There have also been, you know, other kinds of licenses or, you know, grants to companies who have donated through the electoral bond scheme. Again, this completely skews the playing field in favor of the ruling party. Again, we've never seen this kind of gaming of the system before, have we?
No, the numbers are different from the past. Thousands of crores of rupees coming in from unidentified parts of the private sector into government, into a political party is new in such a short period of time. The RBI had two fundamental problems with the bond scheme when it was sent to them just before that budget that you referred to in 2017. The first problem was that this is a bearer instrument, which means that it is as good as cash. Somebody giving it to somebody else, a party, means that it is cash. The second point that the RBI raised, which was the more important point and which remains unresolved, is that the RBI said, and this is quite logical, that because the bond has a 15-day window of being operational, a person A could buy a bond, give it to person B at face value or more, and person B would give it to the party. This person B in the middle could be a criminal outfit, it could be a foreign government, it could be a nasty civil society organization, it could be whoever wanted it to make that transaction. This remains unresolved. We have the names of the people who purchased the bonds. We now have the names of the parties who received those bonds. What we don't have are the names of any intermediaries who may have bought the bond from the party purchasing and given it or sold it, or well, given it to the party concerned. So one very important element is the quid pro quo, which is on display, that you've got companies that have benefited, companies that have got into trouble and then have gotten out of trouble after they've paid the BJP, gambling companies. On display, I think what should follow from here in a normal democratic state is a series of FIRs that look at the transactions and examine whether there is a criminal activity in these exchanges. Did the BJP receive this money in exchange for either extorting it out of corporate sector companies or in exchange for closing cases that the ED and the CBI had opened? I think of the many things that we are seeing today, I don't know whether this is necessarily the worst, because so many things have come out in the last 60 days that have made this election so vitiated that it's difficult to say that even something of this magnitude is not necessarily or possibly the worst thing, which says something about the 2024 election and the way it's going. I think that what we will end up with is a government that most likely will be controlled by the BJP, which will retain the stigma and the stain of illegality through its terms, linking it to governments in the neighborhood of India, going back to Bhutto's in 77, and currently Bangladesh is under Sheikh Hasina.
Right. You know, you said that the RBI had flagged objections to the electoral bond scheme, which the government just ignored. I want to talk a little bit about the sidelining of the RBI, again, as an institution that the government just doesn't pay any attention to and so is not able to perform crucial functions.
Yeah, it's sad that in a country this size, in an economy this size, deliberate destroying of an institution that has taken decades to build, that Modi didn't build the RBI. The RSS did not build the RBI. It was those who came before them who did. And I think it's thoroughly destroyed. It has very little credibility. I'll give a few examples. It has such little credibility that even the data it puts out, the government doesn't pay heed to. Since 2016, the RBI has been putting out every 2 months a survey that it conducts in 19 cities. It asks people a couple of questions. The main one is, are you better off economically today than you were a year ago? For the last 7 years, except for one period, April, May 2019, every month a majority of Indians have said, no, we are not better off than we were last year. Continuously. This is not something that the government refers to when it says we are the fastest growing economy and we're doing well and so on. The RBI itself is saying that we are not. Its own survey is saying that we are not. But the two instances where its credibility was destroyed, one was bonds, where somebody noticed in the finance ministry that the introduction of the bond scheme in 2017 would mean changing the RBI Act. And so a note was sent to the RBI on Saturday, the week before the budget. On Monday, the RBI came back with a reply which said, this is a bad idea. The bond is as good as cash. You won't know who the ultimate person who gives the bond to the party is. The response from the government was, oh, this reply has come too late. And we don't think the RBI has fully understood the bond scheme. And therefore, we are going to do it anyway. This is not how you treat the Reserve Bank of India. The other instance, going back only a year before, was demonetization. The government told the RBI, we are doing this. It gave four reasons. We know the reasons. It said that money supply versus, in 2016 was much greater than it was in terms of GDP growth. Secondly, that it would hit at black money. Secondly, it would hit at counterfeit money. Thirdly, it would hit at corruption. The RBI sent a reply on each of those four points saying the government was wrong, that the government was referring to real GDP growth, the growth in currency was nominal, and so this had not been accommodated. Most black money was held as real estate or gold. So going after cash would not make any difference. This is the RBI saying it. The RBI said that counterfeit money is such a small proportion of total cash in circulation that it wouldn't matter if you destroyed all of your currency and brought in new. Having laid threadbare the argument the government had made and then destroyed it, the RBI nonetheless capitulated and offered its rubber stamp to the government. And we know what happened after that. I think that's shameful. And when there was a pressure on the RBI to release that information through RTIs, the then governor of the RBI, Urjit Patel, shamefully said that there's a national security issue, so he can't, and there's a threat to people in the RBI, and therefore he can't release the minutes. Which is not the way that an institution that has been built over so many decades, that has carried the credibility that it has over the decades, should have responded. I think it's shameful. And I think there's so many things to pull out and talk about in this government's 10 years that this has become a complete sideshow. It's right. Not even a poll issue. You know, the fact that we've destroyed the election commission, the RBI, these are just things that happen.
Right. You know, and in a bit, I want to ask you also about COVID and how that is also not a poll issue when it should be. I mean, in most people are not even thinking of that. It feels like public memory is so short. But just before we get to that, the third thing I said in my introduction, and that was about the crackdown on the opposition. Now you have Hemant Soren, who is the chief minister of Jharkhand and resigned just a day before he was arrested. He is in jail. Arvind Kejriwal, who is still the sitting chief minister of Delhi, who is also in jail, and both on charges of corruption. Meanwhile, the Congress party has said that it's had its bank accounts frozen. It has no funds to buy ads or pay party workers. I mean, at the risk of repeating myself, have we seen this kind of crackdown before?
Never. We have. India has not seen a poll like this. This is Putin-esque, what we are doing to ourselves. To some extent, it resembles what's happening in Bangladesh today,
right,
where the Awami League has pretty much either locked up all of its primary opposition or not allowed them to function. This has not happened in India before. I think you would find bitterly contested elections in India in the past, some of which were violent. And I think that going back not too many decades, I think that the polls of 1991 and 96 in particular were quite shameful, that we were debating over whether or not a monument ought to be brought down. 3,000 people died after that, were killed, I should say. And then the party that was responsible for this was rewarded, that they doubled their vote share, they doubled their seats. Even that period wasn't as undemocratic as this is. You could say, okay, people voted for Madhvani's BJP and they had the right to vote for them, and a court found Advani not guilty, so it's all good. I don't accept that, but I think even that pales in comparison to what we are seeing. Institutional capture, institutional abuse, the manhandling of the opposition. But this is not going to be referred to as a free and fair election. It, globally speaking, it will not be. That there's a report from the Financial Times' editorial team yesterday, which said that this is not. And it won't be. You can't lock up your opponents and say that I'm conducting a free and fair election. You can't freeze your opponents' bank accounts and say that they have as good a chance to win as I do. That's false. It's a lie. And I think that we are unfortunately falling into a pattern which doesn't end on the day of counting. This is the problem with vitiated elections, with bogus polling, with polls that are neither free nor fair, that they don't end on the day when the victor is declared. They continue for the 5 years that government remains in office. The opposition doesn't go away. It doesn't accept defeat because it believes, rightly so in this case, that it was defeat that was colored by criminal activity, by abuse of authority. And who is to say they are wrong? If their chief ministers are in jail and their bank accounts are frozen, it would take a very brave person to say that they are not being manhandled, that this is free and fair. Of course, the chamchas of Modi will say it's free and fair. They are not the people who will have a say in this. I think what will happen is, once Mr. Modi wins his third term, as he's expected to, as I expect him to do, maybe not with as large a majority as he thinks he will get, there will be a problem. Governing India will become difficult. But he will not control all of India. There will be opposition in some states. There will be opposition that believes that it has wrongly been dealt the cards that it has, that it was wrongfully defeated. And they will not let that go. And I think that it is, for this reason, it's dangerous for the Republic that Modi should do this. And I think that his selfishness shows in the fact that he's willing to do it, despite maybe knowing he's not very smart. So maybe he doesn't know that this is the level of damage he's doing to the Republic. But those around him, and certainly those who observe him, should introduce a note of caution. This is not the way that normal democracies function.
You know, interestingly, the columnist Ejaz Ashraf, you know, wrote in a column that he had Imagining Modi Out of Power, where he makes the case that if the NDA is about 30 or 40 seats short of an absolute majority, then everyone, the BJP, its allies, the RSS, will really leave Modi out to dry. That is why he is determined to go so hard after the opposition, because he cannot take that risk. He wants to get those 370 seats for the BJP and 400 for the NDA to consolidate his power, because he has too much at risk, that he has gone after people so hard that if he is not in power anymore, they are going to come back at him equally on the same terms. What do you make of that argument?
This is the standard trope of all authoritarian states, that once you take power, you believe you're doing well. You abolish a currency, not because you think it's going to damage the country, but because you have had this brilliant sort of brainwave, and then you do it and then it doesn't work. In the end, and we are in year 10 now, it always comes down to the fact that you can't let go of power, because letting go of power will mean damage. It will mean that what you have done unto others will be done unto you. And this is what the destruction of the Republic means, that you have removed from the rule of the games those bits that kept the game sacrosanct. That even when you had violence in polling in Bihar and ballot stuffing and all that, at the end of the day, the parties that gathered in the Lok Sabha after counting day more or less believed that this had been free and fair. I don't think that's going to be the case this time. The result, when it comes out on June the 4th, there will be, if things continue in this vein, it could still be the case that the government very suddenly reverses everything it's done, unfreezes bank accounts, doesn't go after the opposition's chief ministers, makes sure that the ED falls in line, files the FIRs on the bonds. That's not going to happen. At least I don't think it's going to happen. But what that will lead us to is a point on June 4 where the election hasn't really ended. And it hasn't ended because the opposition doesn't accept that this is a clean defeat. And it doesn't accept it's a clean defeat because its hands were tied during the entire campaign, and the BJP misused and abused authority in a way that has not happened in India before.
But Akar, what does that lead us to, apart from just like, you know, a protracted legal proceedings, if the BJP still forms the government and, you know, continues with its agenda while the opposition is running around in the courts?
Let's look at what's happened in Pakistan. So in Pakistan, what happened was that the army took over, that for a long period after 77, the army remained in power, that it used the government's excesses as an excuse to remain in power. And the fact that there was anarchy in Pakistan, or so the army said, required that there be a strongman rule after that. So that's one. The other is that you have a democracy without an opposition, which is the Bangladesh model. You have a permanent majority of one party, as we've seen in Gujarat. And that party remains in power for as long as it wants. It is fair to say that the BJP also controls a very wide swathe of the popular vote, and remains very popular in large parts of the country, and will continue to remain no matter what the news on the economy or jobs is. And that's fine. But I'm saying that that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about specifically is that, other than its performance, what it brings to the table in terms of thuggishness and weaponry with which it intimidates and binds its opponents and blackmails them, doesn't constitute a normal democracy. And that's what we are seeing in Bangladesh, that you've got a person in power who remain in power, and the opposition more or less either in jail or come out of power for decades.
A quick note before we go further. You can read stories about the one-sided election in Bangladesh by our contributors Kamal Ahmed and Anupam Debashish Roy. We also had Salman Rafi Sheikh writing from Pakistan about the crackdown on Imran Khan and his party before the election there. I spoke to political analyst Aisha Siddiqua on this podcast last month, where we got into the implications of Pakistan's election results. We are now bringing you a new series called Modi's India from the Edges, with perspectives from across South Asia, from both within and outside India, on what the last 10 years of Modi's BJP in power has meant for the region, and what a third consecutive Modi term might mean. Himal's in-depth, independent coverage of the whole of South Asia relies on the support of listeners like you. To support our work and to help us produce more podcasts like this one, you can become a patron of the magazine by clicking on the link in the episode notes or by going to our website www.himalmag.com and clicking Support Himal. You can also sign up to our newsletters to keep up with our latest stories, podcasts, events, and more. You'll see a sign-up link to our newsletters also in the episode notes. Now back to our conversation with Akar Patel. Akar, in Bangladesh this year, the Awami League had jailed so many of the opposition party, the Bangladesh Nationalist Party's members, that it boycotted elections. In India, what does the opposition do where it is being increasingly paralyzed and cannot contest under fair conditions?
Well, there will be spaces for it that are available even after the 4th of June. Some will be the states that they control. There, it is true that the scope is being limited, that law and order is ostensibly a state subject, but you use the central agencies to go into states and target their governments, whether in Bengal or Jharkhand or Delhi or Karnataka or Tamil Nadu, for that matter. So that space exists, which will be used. I think that while the judiciary has become what is called an executive judiciary, especially on bail matters, there is some space for a pushback. I think the bonds judgment was very good. I think that while there is a certain degree of a pessimism in the institutions, some space exists. And that space will be used. The opposition is not going to stay at home merely because the government decides to not have a free and fair poll. They have the option. They've seen what pushes the government back. And I think the farmers' protests, the Shaheen Bagh protests show that a government, even an all-powerful government with 300 seats in the Lok Sabha, has its limits on what it can impose on the ground. And that's the reason why we don't have a nationwide NRC or we don't have the farm laws anymore. So I don't think that space will go away. But it's because that space exists that we will see levels of friction higher, because there will be a sense of wrongdoing that the opposition will bring to its argument against the government, which will not go away on the 4th of June. And it will not go away for the full 5 years.
And now I want to come to COVID and how and why it is not really being talked about in these elections at all, because it is something that affected everyone in the country. Millions of people died. So many families lost one or several members. People were, you know, economically just completely destroyed. We saw those awful images day after day of people walking home for like hundreds of kilometers. And yet we're not talking about it in this election at all. Is it because public memory is short? Or is it because people think that, look, it happened all around the world and don't see the mismanagement of the Modi government during that time?
I don't think people think that a good job was done on COVID. So we could go through all of the problems, but very briefly, one was the BBC filed 241 RTIs. Who in government knew that the lockdown was coming that day? The answer was nobody. Not disaster management, not health, not finance, nobody. Modi came, gave his speech and went away. In early 2021, the BJP put out a resolution saying that under the leadership of Modi, COVID has been conquered. This was just before the second wave started. When the second wave started, they deleted that resolution from their website. It's back on the website now. The government has not done a census since 2011. One was due in 2021, which has not happened. But it has also not released the civil deaths register for 2021, which should have been released last year at the latest. It has not come out. It compiles all of the deaths and births in the states, and it would give us a good figure of whether 2021 was an outlier state or not. The reason it's not putting that data out can only lead one to believe that there is bad news in that data. The government says about 500,000, about 5 lakh people died in all. Lancet says it's about 40 lakh people, 4 million. On vaccines also, similar story, that they did the government slacked off, then it commandeered the vaccines paid for by Gavi. And then we let Africa and the other nations that the vaccines were to go to manufactured in India. We've hijacked them basically and distributed them here. So I don't think that people think that the good job was done. We saw those scenes from 2021 and lived through them where the crematoria were overflowing. And for those of us who are fortunate enough to live in flats in cities, we could hear from our homes the sort of ambulance sirens going off. But there's another side to it. I think that I've heard that those in the villages for the first time found the healthcare system that they had access to be attentive. Maybe just as bad as it was before, but at least they were being listened to, they were being called in, they were being given a vaccine, they were being told. So there was some element of engagement with the healthcare system which didn't exist before. So for them, things were always bad. They didn't have access to a hospital. Think about what does daily wage labor mean? It means somebody who doesn't eat the following day if she doesn't work or today. In that kind of situation, with no savings and so on, for them, life is always like a COVID emergency. Death could come, catastrophe could come at any point. The fact that there is the government willing to engage with you, at least on this, would be seen as a positive, or at least would have maybe taken the edge of the negative to some extent, which is why I think that he was able to come out despite a total disaster, maybe the worst performance of any leader during COVID in the world. And that's one reason why he doesn't talk about it himself. But we seem to have moved on from it.
But what about urban voters? Do you think they're assessing Modi and the BJP at all on what happened in those years?
No, I think you give us too much credit in India if you think that we vote on the basis of performance. We are primarily confessional voters. So we vote on the basis of confession, whether that confession is faith, as Mr. Modi has made it become, or that confession is caste, as it is for most Indians in most parts of the country. To some extent, maybe it is pushback against linguistic nationalism and federalism, as it is in some parts of the South. But for the most part, Indians vote on the basis of a patriarchy which comes out of sort of identity, faith, caste, community. And I don't think that the hallowed middle class is very different from the rest of the population. In fact, I would think it's even more infected by stupidity and the idea that India suddenly become a great power, and disregarding the fact that Bangladesh has eclipsed India in per capita GDP terms in 2019. That is not part of the debate. So it's quite a comical time in a comical place where performance doesn't matter. Pantomime and sort of circus-like behavior. What other world leader refers to himself in the third person? I can't think of anybody. Hosni Mubarak, I'm told, is the model for somebody who, like a four-year-old boy wearing his name on his suit. But, I mean, this is not mature behavior. And I think that lack of maturity from the leadership shown in the polity, that I don't think that the middle class votes on the basis of... The middle class is actually telling the RBI every month that I'm not as well off as I was 365 days ago. This is what the RBI is saying to us. 19 cities. It's astonishing. I think that there are two things for people like me, I think. One is the kind of dismay of being a citizen and somebody who lives in this part of the world and loves it and loves its food and its culture and its people and loves the nation. And the other is, as a writer, that there's this incredible material that you won't get this anywhere else in the world. You know, how do you, like, even documenting it, you write a book on the Modi years, where do you start? Like, which part of the polity has he not left undamaged, you know, and gratuitously?
Talking about the messaging to voters, and there's a lot of propaganda now. We're seeing more kind of propaganda movies than I think we've ever seen before. Are these really effective? And, you know, I'm not even talking about how well they're doing at the box office or whatever, but is this tapping into that voter, kind of reminding them of these emotions that they want to evoke before they go to the...
It's consolidation of something that's already happened rather than new ground that is being dug. I don't think there are too many Indians who wait till voting day. I think it's 18th April for me in Bangalore, before they decide, oh, I think I'll vote for this candidate or this party. I think we pretty much made up our minds that this is who we are. Lots of people even have a wider identification with the BJP's ideology, in the sense that you find in the US that you have conservatives or Democrats who are ideologically attached to the things that their party talks about. In our instance, unfortunately, it's about the persecution of minorities. But there are people who agree with that and want more of that. The interesting thing in India is that if you don't want the persecution of Muslims, I don't want it, or you don't want it to be the focal point of government, you could vote for TMC, PDP, ADMK, DMK, any number of parties. You could have any number of options. I voted for the BSP most of my life. If you want the persecution of Muslims to continue through law and policy, if you want the exclusion of Muslims to continue, as it has today, we don't have a single minister or parliamentarian from the ruling party who is a Muslim. There is only one party for you.
And this is the biggest flaw of the argument, if not Modi, then who? There are plenty of people, right?
Of course, there are plenty of people. It's not as if India is disintegrated when you had parties with, you know, majorities of with a pluralities of 60 seats and 50 seats and 70 seats, as we had in the 90s. It's not as if there was no economic growth. Then it's not as if our enemies were able to come and attack us or whatever. It's life went on. If not Modi, who is a dumb argument? Firstly, it's not a logical argument in a parliamentary system. Nobody asks in the UK after Rishi Sunak coup. Yeah, somebody will come. I don't think they'll come in 2024 because I think that the BJP will win. But on the off chance that I'm wrong and the BJP doesn't get to 260, I think that there will be somebody who will, you know, step up and whoever that is will be fine.
Right. You know, and another aspect to this narrative that going into the election, Modi himself just now in an interview to a Tamil TV channel, I think, and they brought up the electoral bonds issue. And then he's kind of trying to flip the script saying that I brought in the electoral bonds and now because and it wasn't perfect, but because the Supreme Court has asked for the details, there is transparency, where there was no transparency before the electoral bond scheme.
That's a lie. Before the bonds, you had a checkbook. No, you could. What does the bond do? The bond says that you can have a, forget what I said earlier about there being a middleman who could, a sort of potential middleman who could buy the bond from somebody and give it to a party. Even if we leave that aside, and to my mind, that is the biggest problem with the bond. What is the bond? The bond is a payment that goes out of one person's bank account or one company's bank account into one party's bank account. What is the check? It is exactly the same thing, except that it is transparent. The bond is not.
Right. But that is the fact of it. What about the narrative of it?
He can lie because I think that he needs to consolidate the people who are sort of already with him. I find it hard to believe that there are neutral people who are inclined towards Modi who think that what's being done to Kejriwal or to Sisodia is right. Forget, Umar Khalid. What about Sisodia? What about Kejriwal? Is it right to jail your opponents during a polling cycle? I find it hard to believe that there are people in the Modi camp who are not utter bigots, who think that, this is the way things ought to be run. It is unacceptable in any democratic state that this kind of behavior runs. But he gets away with it. That is what messianism means. It means that whatever you utter is the truth. If it's a bold-faced lie, as was the case in the bonds issue, and it was a lie from him, it's okay. If the media is on your side for the most part and you're following, they are called bhakts for a reason. Bhakti comes from faith. It doesn't come from the scientific method. You don't sort of arrive at, you just instinctively fall at his feet. And then whatever comes out of his mouth is okay.
Akar, when, if the BJP comes back, or the NDA, with the BJP as the major partner, what is on their agenda for a third term? As soon as he came back to power, as soon as Modi came back to power in 2019, we saw the reading down of Article 370 and Jammu and Kashmir being turned into union territories. What's next in a third term of Modi?
Good question. I think that there is no theory of state that Hindutva has. So to give you an example, which is a neighborhood example, in Pakistan, the theory of state was that, okay, we will try and introduce an Islamic state where sovereignty belongs to Allah. But then they didn't know what that meant in terms of law. If you go to Dhaka, if you go to Karachi, if you go to Lahore, if you say 420, 302, 144, people know what that means. Because it's the same law that the subcontinent has functioned under since Macaulay, since 1860. So Pakistan felt, okay, if we are Islamic, let's do something different. So then what can you do? So they did two types of things. One is they tried to make better Muslims out of their population. So compulsory fasting during Ramzan. The subcontinental Muslim is quite observant in any case. You don't need to force her to fast. But then they ran into trouble because cinema hall owners, restaurant owners said that, people are getting beaten up. We can't do business. What's going on? So then that became a problem. The other one was debiting zakat at the end of Ramzan, 2.5% out of fixed deposit accounts. So then people started to withdraw the money so it would not get debited. So the idea that you would make a more compliant Muslim out of the Pakistan, it didn't work. So then what did work was the persecution of minorities. That in starting in the 60s, they made the office of the president available only to Muslims, that Hindus and Sikhs and Christians could not aspire to become president of Pakistan. And under Bhutto in the 70s, they included the office of the prime minister as well. And then there were laws against other minorities, including the Ahmadiyya and so on. So the focus went there. India doesn't even have that. The only Hindu Rashtra in history in modern times was Nepal till 2008, which was a Hindu Rashtra for two reasons. One is that executive authority came out of a Kshatriya king, the Chhetri dynasty, who claimed that they were born into Kshatriya blood. And the other aspect was that in the court of this Kshatriya king, there was a Brahmin with the title of Mool Purohit. And he would sort of advise the king, I don't know on what, maybe on how to conduct dharma or whatever. But the rest of Smriti, you know, denying Dalits, denying Shudra the right to education, or whatever it is that the Smriti prescribed, that was not actually applied. Because you can't apply it in the year of 2024 or in the year of 2000. You can't tell women that you can't read. So the thing is that if you don't have that structural element of how to become a religious state, what is a Hindu Rashtra, that, then all you can do is the persecution of minorities. And I think that we will see more of the same. That we, when they come back to power, we'll see new ways. Don't eat this, don't wear that, don't marry this person. It's bizarre that India should have passed straight up Nuremberg laws type stuff in seven states in India after 2018, where interfaith marriages are criminalized. That you, in some states, including Madhya Pradesh, the state can undo a marriage between a Hindu and Muslim, including marriages that have children. That the testimony of an adult woman that she converted of free volition is insufficient evidence for the state. The state will ask her, the man she's marrying and the family she's marrying into, to show that there was no coercion. So we are becoming sort of atavistic. And even that's like, there are so many things to talk about, you know. We start with bonds, you go to COVID, you talk about the sort of institutions, you talk about what we are doing for society, you talk about the economy, talk about the jobs. So, I mean, writer's dream, but I think citizen's nightmare.
But do you think that in a third term, the uniform civil code is, you know, coming sooner rather than later? Or is that too difficult to implement because it goes beyond?
It's too difficult to write. It's too difficult to write. How do you write it? How do I, let's say I as a woman want to live with you as a man who's already married. I'm doing it because I'm in love with you. You've got another wife and that's fine with me. What can the state do? What should the state do? We are getting into things that we haven't thought through. We are getting into things that we, like the pushback that will come from reforming inheritance law will not be little. That's one reason why we don't have a draft. You can debate whether something is good, bad, or sort of indifferent if you have the text in front of you. If there's no text, if there's no, you know, why have they not had a text? They had the Uniform Civil Code on their manifesto since before they had the Babri Masjid on their manifesto. Babri Masjid came into their manifesto only in 86. The Uniform Civil Code in 86. By the way, the Janasangh opposed the Ambedkarite reform on inheritance law on the basis, it had two grounds, and this is there in its manifestos. The first ground was that Hindu marriage was eternal. You can't have divorce. And because you can't have divorce, the woman will not be allowed to get any maintenance, get any kind of part of the inheritance. That was one. The second is Hindu society and India revolves around joint family. You cannot divide the property into what brother gets and sister gets because it's all one thing. And for years, at least a decade and a half, they continued with this argument till they let it go because they felt that their core a constituency. And people started to get divorced from 50s, 60s onward because they were seen as normal, that you can't get along, you're sort of divorced. Mm-hmm. They've changed their position on this, but they don't bring any kind of intellectual heft to anything they do. If they did, after so many decades, at least the 10 years that they've been in office, they would show us a draft. This is what a UCC looks like. Where is that draft? It's not there. Mm-hmm.
And also, like, although the large amount of discourse around it is, polygamy and triple talaq, but Uniform Civil Code goes much beyond Muslim personal law, which is
that's what people don't. I think you're right that the passion on the issue comes out of the idea of a polygamy, which is believed to be mostly done by Muslims and believed to be most the reason for India's population boom. Both those are wrong. India's fertility rate is at replacement levels, and that there is no connect between faith and whatever. It has to do entirely with either which part of the country you are in, north, south, or what your socioeconomic status is. Everybody's coming down rapidly. I think that neither of those arguments apply. But because it's such a visual argument, you know, oh, three women in burqas with this one guy, you know, hum paanch hamare pachis, in the words of the prime minister, this kind of silly trope, you know, That's what people think. That's what gets people upset. But I'd love to see them get into the uniform civil code thing, because it'll require them to work, which they hate, like writing stuff up, you know, like no. And the B is how are you going to implement it? We'll see that. Forget, you know, 370. Article 371 guarantees rights on the issue of personal law to people in the Northeast, to Mizos, to Nagas. Are you going to undo that as well? Let's try that. Let's do it. I'm saying that whatever this government wants, I'm in favor of it, actually, because I think that they, like, the most batshit crazy thing that comes to the top of their head first is what they want to implement without thinking any of it through.
Akar, you've also said before that elections is only one part of the democratic process, right? Democracy is also upheld by citizens exercising their citizenship every day, demanding their rights. You know, where do we go from here as citizens of the country?
So I would say that India is imperfectly authoritarian, just like it is imperfectly secular, imperfectly everything else. That we don't do tyranny very well. And we, like, there will always be some judge who will give some kind of judgment that will undo what I want. There will always be some state that rebels. There will always be some hard-headed sick farmer who will come and park himself with his tractor outside my gate, and then I have to say, okay, sorry, law's gone. So the more public participates in democracy, the higher the returns are for the public. So that's one. I don't think that will change. The second is that, to go back to what you said, that there is this NGO in Washington called Freedom House, this think tank that grades nations on democracies. So in 2021, for the first time, it says that India was partly free. And it's interesting to see that it breaks up its marking system into two parts. One part, which is 40%, is electoral democracy. Do you have the right to form a party? Is voting free and fair? Do the sort of opposition parties have a right to mobilize? Can they blah, blah? Can they operate their bank accounts and so on? The 60% part of what constitutes democracy, according to them, was civil liberties. Do you have the right to a peaceful assembly? Do you have the right to free speech? Do you have, do you have the right to not be jailed sort of more or less permanently without bail if you haven't been convicted? India became partly free not because of its ranking on the former. On the electoral process, it scored really well in 2021 and 2022 and 2023. It lost its ranking and became partly free because of its failings on civil liberties. What has happened in 2024 and late 2023 is that it has started to fail, or has failed, in my opinion, on the first part as well. That we can no longer say that elections are free and fair. We can no longer say with any degree of credibility that the opposition has the same right to function and the same spaces to function as the ruling party does. And that is, and I think that kind of division makes it very stark, makes it very clear where we are and where we continue to slide.
So if this election is going to be as unfree and unfair as we think and fear it is going to be, and that's one more step in this democratic backslide that's been happening over the last few years, what does it mean for the rest of South Asia?
I think that we tend to send the worst of our ideas. We tend to export the worst of our ideas. So if you look at Lanka, or look at laws like UAPPA, PMLA, we are the ones who are the geniuses who write them up first, and then the others actually adopt them. But if you look at India today, the state of its media, if you look at its press freedom rankings, any subject that you and I are talking about, we are talking of like India being right at the bottom of the barrel. You know, I hope that just like they have with manufacturing, they have with women's empowerment, they have with HDI. I think HDI is the one sign that India is a laggard and not really the exporter of ideas in South Asia. That other than Pakistan, every other South Asian nation is sort of ahead of India on the Human Development Index. And that shift has happened relatively recently. Bangladesh was behind India till about 25 years ago. So I hope they don't listen to us. Unfortunately, some of them have been down this road before themselves. So maybe these are bad things we are learning from them. But no good comes out of it. Is Pakistan the exemplar? Is Bangladesh the exemplar for South Asian democracy or global South democracy? No, they're not. I think that for many years, many of us believed that, okay, we are a poor nation, we are brutal, we are chaotic, you know, we are wrong in many ways, But this one thing we have going for us, that we have this constitution that we can look up to that the others don't have in South Asia. We have this electoral process that is free and fair for the most part. Governments come and go. That remains the case. That is no longer the case in 2024. This is a departure for us. For the first time, many of us who have seen the number of elections we have believe that we have gone down already the path that Pakistan and Bangladesh.
Finally, Akar, just, you know, some recommendations of what people might want to, should read, watch, listen to in terms of books, anything, films, podcasts, going into this election.
Sure. So I would always advise people to go back to primary sources. So I think that the BJP and Hindutva after Savarkar did not write anything. So Bunch of Thoughts by Golwalkar is called Bunch of Thoughts because it's just a bunch of speeches that have been strung together. And integral humanism, which the BJP's constitution, the Article 3 of its constitution says is its basic philosophy, is a series of four lectures that were given in Bombay in 1965. It's interesting to go and read those to see what they're saying. It's borderline, I mean, insane that there's no coherence. But I'm saying that to know that, you have to read it yourself. And I would start by reading these three texts.
Akar, thank you so much for joining us today. And we'll see what happens in these elections. That was Akar Patel speaking to Himal South Asian for the State of South Asia podcast. I recommend you read Akar's books, Our Hindu Rashtra and Price of the Modi Years. Keep reading Himal for more on the election in India and for our new series, Modi's India from the Edges. This podcast was edited by Ritika Chauhan. You can find many more stories on politics and culture, reportage and analysis from across South Asia on our website, www.himalmag.com. You can listen to our other podcasts and sign up for our newsletters to keep up with Himal's work. We'll be back in 4 weeks with another in-depth conversation on the next episode of State of South Asia. Thank you for listening and see you then.